Excerpt from Brothers and Keepers, John Edgar Wideman. From Brothers and Keepers by John Edgar Wideman, copyright 1984 by John Wideman. Reprinted with the permission of the Wiley Agency. You remember what we were saying about young black men in the street world life, and trying to understand why the square world becomes completely unattractive to them. It has to do with the fact that their world is the ghetto, and in that world, all the glamour, all the praise and attention is given to the slick guy, the gangster especially, the ones that get over in the life. And it's because we can't help but feel some satisfaction seeing a brother, a black man, get over on these people, on their system, without playing by their rules. No matter how much we have incorporated these rules as our own, we know that they were forced on us by people who did not have our best interests at heart. So this hip guy, this gangster or player or whatever label you give these brothers that we like to shun because of the poison that they spread, we black people still look at them with some sense of pride and admiration. Our children openly, us adults somewhere deep inside. We know they represent rebellion, what little is left in us. Well, having lived in the life, it becomes very hard, almost impossible, to find any contentment in joining the status quo. Too hard to go back to being nobody in a world that hates you. Even if I had struck it rich in the life, I would have managed to throw it down the fast lane, or have lost it on a revolutionary whim. Hopefully the latter. I have always burned up in my fervent passions of desire and want. My senses at times tingle and itch with my romantic, idealistic outlook on life, which has always made me keep my distance from reality. Reality that was a constant insult to my world, to my dreams of happiness and peace, to my people-for-people kind of world, my easy cars for a nickel or a dime sort of world. And these driving passions, this sensitivity to the love and good in people, also turned on me because I used it to play on people and their feelings. These aspirations of love and desire turned on me when I wasn't able to live up to this sweet self-morality. So I began to self-destruct, burning up in my sensitivity, losing direction, because nowhere could I find this world of truth and love and harmony. In the real world, the world left for me, it was unacceptable to be good. It was square to be smart in school. It was jive to show respect to people outside the street world. It was cool to be cold to your woman and the people that loved you. The things we liked, we called bad. Man, that was a bad girl. The world of the angry black kid growing up in the 60s was a world in which to be in was to be out. Out of touch with the square world and all of its rules on what's right and wrong. The thing was to make your own rules, do your own thing, but make sure it's contrary to what society says or is. I shall always pray. Garth looked bad. Real bad. Ichabod Crane anyway, but now he was a skeleton, lying there in the bed with the bones poking through his skin. It made you want to cry. Garth's barely able to talk, his smooth, medium brown skin yellow as pee. Ichabod legs and long hands and long feet, Garth could make you laugh just walking down the street. On the set you'd see him coming a far way off. Three-quarter legs, you knew it had to be Garth, the way he was split up higher in the crotch than anybody else. Wilt the stilt, with a lean bird body perched on top his high waist. Size 15 shoes. Hands could palm a basketball easy as holding a pool cue. Fingers long enough to wrap round a basketball, but Garth couldn't play a lick. Never could get all that lankiness together on the court. You'd look at him sometimes as he was trucking down Homewood Avenue and think, that brother ain't walking. He's trying to remember how to walk. Awkward as a pigeon on roller skates. Knobby joints out of whack, arms and legs flailing, going their separate ways, his body jerking to keep them from going too far. Moving down the street like that wouldn't work. Didn't make sense if you stood back and watched, if you pretended you hadn't seen Garth get where he was going a million times before. Nothing funny now, though. White hospital sheets pulled to his chest. Garth's head always looked small as a tennis ball way up there on his shoulders. Now it's a yellow, shrunken skull. Ever since Robbie had entered the ward, he'd wanted to reach over and hide his friend's arm under the covers. For 2 weeks, Gar had been wasting away in the bed. Bad enough knowing Gar was dying. Didn't need that pitiful stick arm reminding him how close to nothing his main man had fallen. So fast. It could happen so fast. If Robbie tried to raise that arm, it would come off in his hand. As gentle as he could not be gentle enough. The arm would disintegrate, like a long ash off the end of a cigarette. Time to leave. No sense in sitting any longer. Garth not talking, no way of telling whether he was listening either. And Robbie has nothing more to say, choked up the way he gets inside hospitals. Hospital smell and quiet, the bare halls and bare floors, the echoes. Something about all that he can't name, wouldn't try to name, rises in him and chills him. Like his teeth are chattering the whole time he's inside a hospital. Like his entire body is trembling, uncontrollable. Only nobody can see it or hear it but him. Shaking because he can't breathe the stuffy air. Hot and cold at the same time. He's been aching to leave since he entered the ward. Aching to get up and bust through the big glass front doors. Aching to pounce on the spider arm flung back behind Gar's head. The arm too wasted to belong to his friend. He wants to grab it and hurl it away. Robbie pulls on tight white gloves the Undertaker had dealt out to him and the rest of the pallbearers. His brown skin shows through the thin material, turns the white dingy. He's remembering that last time in Garth's ward, the hospital stink, hot, chilly air, a bare arm protruding from the sleeve of the hospital gown, more dried-up toothpick than arm, a withered twig, with Garth's fingers like a bunch of skinny brown bananas drooping from the knobby tip. Robbie had studied the metal guts of the hospital bed, the black scuff marks swirling round the chair's legs. When he'd finally risen to go, his chair scraping against the vinyl floor broke a long silence. The noise must have roused Garth's attention. He'd spoken again.
"You're a good man. Don't ever forget, Rob. You're the best."
Garth's first words since the little banter back and forth when Robbie had entered the ward and dragged the chair to the side of Gar's bed. A whisper scarcely audible now that Robbie was standing. Garth had tried to grin. The best he could manage was a pained adjustment of the bones on his face. No more than a shadow scudding across the yellow skull. But Robbie had seen the famous smile. He hesitated, stopped rushing toward the door long enough to mile back, because that was Gar. That was the way Gar was. He always had a smile and a good word for his cut buddies. Garth's grin was money in the bank. You could count on it like you could count on a good word from him. Something in his face would tell you you were all right, better than all right, that he believed in you, that you were, as he'd just whispered, the best. You could depend on Garth to say something to make you feel good even though you knew he was lying. With that grin greasing the lie, you had to believe it. Even though you knew better. Garth was the gang's dreamer. When he talked, you could see his dreams. That's why Robbie had believed it, seen the grin, the bright shadow lighting Garth's face an instant. Out of nothing, out of pain, fear, the certainty of death gripping them both, Garth's voice had manufactured the grin. Now they had to bury Garth. A few days after the visit to the hospital, the phone rang. And it was Garth's mother with the news of her son's death. Not really news. Robbie had known it was just a matter of time. Of waiting for the moment when somebody else's voice would pronounce the words he'd said to himself 100 times. He's gone. Gar's dead. Long gone before the telephone rang. Gar was gone when they stuck him up in the hospital bed. By the time they'd figured out what ailed him and admitted him to the hospital, it was too late. The disease had turned him to a skeleton. Nothing left of Gar to treat. They hid his messy death under white sheets, perfumed it with disinfectant, pumped him full of drugs so he wouldn't disturb his neighbors. The others had squeezed into their pallbearers' gloves, cheap white cotton gloves. You could use them once and throw them away. Michael, Cecil, and Sowell were pallbearers too. With Robbie and 2 men from Garth's family, they would carry the coffin from Gaines' funeral parlor to the hearse. Robbie counted 4 black fingers in the white gloves. Garth was the thumb. The hand would be clumsy, wouldn't work right without him. Garth was different, but everybody else was different too. Mike, the Iceman, super cool. Cecil, indifferent, ready to do most anything or nothing, and couldn't care less which it was. Sowell wasn't really part of the gang. He didn't hang with them. Didn't like to take the risks that were part of the life. Sowell kept a good job. The life, for him, was just a way to make quick money. He didn't shoot up. He thought of himself as a businessman, an investor, not a partner in their schemes. They knew Sowell mostly through Garth. Perhaps things would change now. the four survivors closer after they shared the burden of Gar's coffin, after they hoisted it and slid it on steel rollers into the back of Gaines' Cadillac hearse. Robbie was grateful for the gloves. He'd never been able to touch anything dead. He'd taken a beating once from his father, rather than touch the bloody mousetrap his mother had nudged to the back door with her toe and ordered him to empty. The brass handle of the coffin felt damp through the glove. He gripped tighter to stop the flow of blood or sweat or whatever it was leaking from him or seeping from the metal. Garth had melted down to nothing by the end, so it couldn't be him nearly yanking off Robbie's shoulder when the box shifted and its weight shot forward. Felt like the coffin full of bricks. Robbie stared across at Mike, but Mike was a soldier, eyes front, riveted to the yawning rear door of the hearse. Mike's eyes wouldn't admit it, but they'd almost lost the coffin. They were rookie pallbearers, and maneuvering down the carpet front steps of Gaines' funeral parlor, they'd almost let Garth fly out of their hands. They needed somebody who knew what he was doing. An old steady head to show them the way. They needed Garth, but Garth was long gone, ashes inside the steel box. They began drinking later that afternoon in Garth's people's house. Women and food in one room, men hitting the whiskey hard in another. It was a typical project apartment, the kind everybody had stayed in or visited one time or another. Small, shabby, featureless. Not a place to live. No matter what you did to it, how clean you kept it, or what kind of furniture you loaded it with, the walls and ceilings were not meant to be home for anybody. A place you passed through. Not yours, because the people who'd been there before you left their indelible marks everywhere, and you couldn't help adding your bruises and knots for the next tenants. You could rent a kitchen and a bedroom and a bathroom and a living room. The project flats were laid out so you had a room for each of the things people did in houses. Problem was, every corner was cut. Living cramped is one thing, and people can get cozy in the closest quarters. It's another thing to live in a place designed to be just a little less than adequate. No slack, no space to personalize, to stamp the flat with what's peculiar to your style. Like a man sitting on a toilet seat that's too small, and the toilet too close to the bathtub so his knees shove against the enamel edge. He can move his bowels that way, and plenty of people in the world have a lot less, but he'll never enjoy sitting there, never feel the deep-down comfort of belonging where he must squat. Anyway, the whiskey started flowing in that little project apartment. Robbie listened, for Garth's sake, as long as he could, to old people reminiscing about funerals they'd attended, about all the friends and relatives they'd escorted to the edge of Jordan. Old folks sipping good whiskey and moaning and groaning till it seemed a sin to be left behind on this side of the river, after so many saints had crossed over. He listened to people express their grief, tell sad, familiar stories. As he got high, he listened less closely to the words. Faces and gestures revealed more than enough. When he split with Mike and Cecil and their ladies, Sowell tagged along. But then the tacky, low-ceilinged rooms of the flat were packed. Loud talk, laughter, storytellers competing for audiences. Robbie half expected the door he pushed shut behind himself to pop open again, waited for bottled-up noise to explode into the funky hallway. "Hey, man," Rob caught Mike's eye. Then Cecil and Sowell turned to him. They knew he was speaking to everybody. Late now, 10, 11, because it had been dark outside for hours. Quiet now, too quiet in his pad. And too much smoke and drink since the funeral. From a bare bulb in the kitchen ceiling, light seeped down the hallway and hovered dimly in the doorway of the room where they sat. Robbie wondered if the others felt as bad as he did. If the cemetery clothes itched their skin. If they could smell grave dust on their shoes. He hoped they'd finish this last jug of wine and let the day be over. He needed sleep. Downtime to get the terrible weight of Garth's death off his mind. He'd been grateful for the darkness. For the company of his cut buddies after the funeral. For the Sun Ra tape, until it ended and plunged them into a deeper silence than he'd ever known. Garth was gone. In a few days, people would stop talking about him. He was in the ground, stone cold dead. Robbie had held a chunk of crumbly ground in his white-gloved fingers and smashed it and dropped the dust into the hole. Now the ground had closed over Garth, and what did it mean? Here one day and gone the next, and that was that. They'd bury somebody else out of Gaines tomorrow. People would dress up and cry and get drunk and tell lies, and next day it'd be somebody else's turn to die. Which one of the shadows in this black room would go first? What did it matter? Who cared? Who would remember their names? They were ghosts already. Dead as Garth already. Only difference was, Garth didn't have it to worry about no more. Garth didn't have to pretend he was going anywhere, 'cause he was there. He'd made it to the place they were all headed fast as their legs could carry them. Every step was a step closer to the stone-cold ground, the pitch-black hole where they'd dropped Garth's body. "Hey, you all. We got a drink to Garth one last time." They clinked glasses in the darkness. Robbie searched for something to say. The right words wouldn't come. He knew there was something proper and precise that needed to be said, because the exact words eluded him, because only the right words would do. He swallowed his gulp of heavy, sweet wine in silence. "It's our time now. We can't let Garth down. Let's drink this last one for him and promise him we'll do what he said we could. We'll be the best. We'll make it to the top for him. We'll do it for Garth." My brother had said something about a guy named Garth during one of my visits to the prison. Just a name mentioned in passing, Garth or Gar. I'd asked Robbie to spell it for me. Garth had been a friend of Robbie's, about Robbie's age, who died one summer of a mysterious illness. Later, when Robbie chose to begin the story of the robbery and killing by saying, "It started with Gar dying," I remembered that first casual mention, and remembered a conversation with my mother. My mom and I were in the kitchen of the house on Tokay Street. My recollection of details was vague at first, but something about the conversation had made a lasting impression, because 6 years later, hearing Robbie say the name Garth brought back my mother's words. My mother worried about Robbie all the time. Whenever I visited home, sooner or later, I'd find myself alone with Mom, and she'd pour out her fears about Robbie's wildness, the deep trouble he was bound for, the web of entanglements and intrigues and bad company he was weaving around himself with a maddening disregard for the inevitable consequences. "I don't know. I just don't know how to reach him. He won't listen. He's doing wrong and he knows it, but nothing I say makes any difference. He's not like the rest of y'all. You'd misbehave, but I could talk to you or smack you if I had to, and you'd straighten up. With Robbie, it's like talking to a wall." I'd listen and get angry at my brother, because I registered not so much the anger he was bringing on himself, but the effect of his escapades on the woman who'd brought us both into the world. After all, Robbie was no baby. If he wanted to mess up, nobody could stop him. Also, Robbie was my brother, meaning that his wildness was just a stage, a chaotic phase of his life that would only last till he got his head together and decided to start doing right, doing as the rest of us did. He was my brother. He couldn't fall too far. His brushes with the law, I'd had some too. The time he'd spent in jail were serious but temporary setbacks. I viewed his troubles, when I thought about them at all, as a form of protracted juvenile delinquency, and fully expected Robbie would learn his lesson sooner or later and return to the fold. The prodigal son, chastened. Perhaps a better person for the experience. In the meantime, the most serious consequences of his wildness was Mom's devastating unhappiness. She couldn't sustain the detachment, the laissez-faire optimism I had talked myself into. Because I was 2,000 miles away, in Wyoming, I didn't have to deal with the day-to-day evidence of Robbie's trouble. The syringe Mom found under his bed, the $20 bill missing from her purse, the times he'd cruise in higher than a kite, his pupils reduced to pinpricks with his crew, and they'd raid the refrigerator and make a loud, sloppy feast, all of them feeling so good they couldn't imagine anybody not up there on Cloud 9 with them, enjoying the time of their lives. Cruising in, then disappearing just as abruptly, leaving their dishes and pans and mess behind. Robbie covering Mom with kisses and smiles and drowning her in baby talk hoochie-coo as he staggers through the front door. Her alone in the ravaged, silent kitchen, listening as doors slam and a car squeals off on the cobblestones of Tokay, wondering where they're headed next, wishing, praying Robbie will return and eat and eat and eat till he falls asleep at the table, so she can carry him upstairs and tuck him in and kiss his forehead and shut the door gently on his sleep. I wasn't around for all that. Didn't want to know how bad things were for him. Worrying about my mother was tough enough. I could identify with her grief. I could blame my brother. An awful situation, but simple too. My role, my responsibilities, and loyalties were clear. The wildness was to blame.
and it was a passing thing. So I just had to help my mother survive the worst of it. Then everything would be all right. I'd steel myself for the moments alone with her, when she'd tell me the worst. In the kitchen, usually, over a cup of coffee, with the radio playing. When my mother was alone in the house on Tokay, either the TV or a radio or both were always on. Atop the kitchen table, a small clock radio turned to WAMO, one of Pittsburgh's soul stations, would background with scratchy gospel music whatever we said in the morning in the kitchen. On a morning like that in 1975, while I drank a cup of coffee and part of me, still half-sleep, hidden, swayed to the soft beat of gospel, my mother had explained how upset Robbie was over the death of his friend Garth. It was a terrible thing. I've known Garth's mother for years. He was a good boy. No saint for sure. But deep down, a good boy. Like your brother. Not a mean bone in his body. Out there in the street doing wrong, but that's where most of them are. What else can they do, John? Sometimes I can't blame them. No jobs, no money in their pockets. How are they supposed to feel like men? Garth did better than most. Whatever else he was into, he kept that little job over at Westinghouse and helped out his mother. A big, playful kid, always smiling. I think that's why him and Robbie were so tight. Neither one had good sense. Giggled and acted like fools. Garth no wider than my finger. Straight up and down. A string bean if I ever saw one. When Robbie lived here in the house with me, Garth was always around. I know how bad Robbie feels. He hasn't said a word, but I know. When Robbie's quiet, you know something's wrong. Soon as his eyes pop open in the morning, he's looking for the party. First thing in the morning, he's chipper and chattering, looking for the party. That's your brother. He had a match in Garth. Shame the way they did that boy. He'd been down to the clinic 2 or 3 times, but they sent him home. Said he had an infection, and it would take care of itself. Something like that, anyway. You know how they are down there. Have to be spitting blood to get attention. Then all they give you is a Band-Aid. He went back 2 times, but they kept telling him the same dumb thing. Anybody who knew Garth could see something awful was wrong. Circles under his eyes, sallow look to his skin, losing weight, and the poor thing didn't have any weight to lose. Last time I saw him, I was shocked. Just about shocked out my shoes. Wasn't Garth standing in front of me? Not the boy I knew. Well, to make a long story short, they finally took him in the hospital, but it was too late. They let him walk the streets till he was dead. It was wrong, worse than wrong, how they did him. But that's how those dogs do us every day God sends here. Garth's gone, so nothing nobody can say will do any good. I feel so sorry for his mother. She lived for that boy. I called her and tried to talk, but what can you say? I prayed for her and prayed for Garth and prayed for Robbie. A thing like that tears people up. It's worse if you keep it inside. And that's your brother's way. He'll let it eat him up and then go out and do something crazy. Until she told me Garth's story, I guess I hadn't realized how much my mother had begun to change. She had always seemed to me to exemplify the tolerance, the patience, the long view epitomized in her father. John French's favorite saying was, "Give him the benefit of the doubt." She could get as ruffled, as evil as the rest of us, cry and scream, or tear around the house fit to be tied. She had her grudges and quarrels. Mom could let it all hang out. Yet most of the time she radiated a deep calm. She reacted strongly to things, but at the same time held judgment in abeyance. Events, personalities, always deserved a second, slower appraisal, an evaluation outside the sphere of everyday hassles and vexations. You gave people the benefit of the doubt. You attempted to remove your ego, acknowledge the limitations of your individual view of things. You consulted as far as you were equipped by temperament and intelligence, a broader, more abiding set of relationships and connections. You tried on the other person's point of view. You sought the other, better person in yourself, who might talk you into relinquishing for a moment your selfish interest in whatever was at issue. You stopped and considered the long view, possibilities other than the one that momentarily was leading you by the nose. You gave yourself and other people the benefit of the doubt. My mother had that capacity. I'd admired, envied, and benefited infinitely from its presence. As she related the story of Garth's death and my brother's anger and remorse, her tone was uncompromisingly bitter. No slack, no margin of doubt was being granted to the forces that destroyed Garth
and still pursued her son. She had exhausted her reserves of understanding and compassion. The long view supplied the same ugly picture as the short. She had an enemy now. It was that revealed truth that had given the conversation its edge, its impact. They had killed Garth, and his dying had killed part of her son. So the battle lines were drawn, irreconcilably, absolutely. The backside of John French's motto had come into play. Giving someone the benefit of the doubt was also giving him rope enough to hang himself. If a person takes advantage of the benefit of the doubt and keeps on taking and taking, one day the rope plays out. The piper must be paid. If you've been the one giving, it becomes incumbent on you to grip your end tight and take away. You turn the other cheek, but slowly, cautiously, and keep your fist balled up at your side. If your antagonist decides to smack rather than kiss you or leave you alone, you make sure you get in the first blow, and make sure it's hard enough to knock him down. Before she told Garth's story, my mother had already changed. But it took years for me to realize how profoundly she hated what had been done to Garth and then Robbie. The gentleness of my grandfather, like his fair skin and good French hair, had been passed down to my mother. Gentleness styled the way she thought, spoke, and moved in the world. Her easy disposition and sociability masked the intensity of her feelings. Her attitude to authority of any kind, doctors, clerks, police, bill collectors, newscasters, whites in general, partook of her constitutional gentleness. She wasn't docile or cowed. The power other people possessed, or believed they possessed, didn't frighten her. She accommodated herself, offered something they could accept as deference, but that was in fact the same resigned, alert attention she paid to roaches or weather or poverty, any of the givens outside herself that she couldn't do much about. She never engaged in public tests of will, never pushed herself or her point of view on people she didn't know. Social awkwardness embarrassed her. Like most Americans, she didn't like paying taxes, was suspicious of politicians, resented the disparity between big and little people in our society, and the double standard that allowed big shots to get away with murder. She paid particular attention to news stories that reinforced her basic political assumption that power corrupts. On the other hand, she knew the world was a vale of tears, and one's strength, granted by God, to deal with life's inevitable calamities should not be squandered on small stuff. In spite of all of her temperamental and philosophical resistance to extremes, my mother would be radicalized. What the demonstrations, protest marches, and slogans of the 60s had not affected would be accomplished by Garth's death and my brother's troubles. She would become an aggressive, acid critic of the status quo in all its forms. From the president, "If it wasn't for that rat, I'd have a storm door to go with the storm windows, but he cut the program." On down to bank tellers. "I go there every Friday, and I'm one of the only black faces she sees all day, and she knows me as well as she knows that wart on her cheek, but she'll still make me show my license before she'll cash my check." A son she loved would be pursued, captured, tried, and imprisoned by the forces of law and order. Throughout the ordeal, her love for him wouldn't change, couldn't change. His crime tested her love, and also tested the nature of the intent of the forces arrayed against her son. She had to make a choice. On one side were the stark facts of his crime. Robbery, murder, flight. Her son an outlaw, a fugitive, then a prisoner. On the other side, the guardians of society. The laws, courts, police, judges, and keepers who were responsible for punishing her son's transgression. She didn't invent the two sides, and initially didn't believe there could be a middle ground. She extended the benefit of the doubt, trying to situate herself somewhere in between, acknowledging the evil of her son's crime while simultaneously holding on to the fact that he existed as a human being before, after, and during the crime he'd committed. He'd done wrong, but he was still Robbie, and she'd always be his mother. Strangely, on the dark side, the side of the crime and its terrible consequences, she would find room to exercise her love. As negative as the elements were, a life taken, the grief of the survivors, suffering, waste, guilt, remorse, the scale was human. She could apply her sense of right and wrong. Her life to that point had equipped her with values, with tools for sorting out and coping with disaster. So she would choose to make her fight there, on treacherous yet familiar ground, familiar since her son was there. And she could place herself, a woman, a mother, a grieving, bereaved human being, there beside him. Nothing like that was possible on the other side. The legitimacy of the other side was grounded not in her experience of life, but in a set of rules seemingly framed to sidestep, ignore, or replace her sense of reality. Accepting the version of reality encoded in their rules would be like stepping into a cage and locking herself in. Definitions of her son, herself, of need and frailty and mercy, of blackness and redemption and justice, had all been neatly formulated. No need here for her questions, her uncertainty, her fear, her love. Everything was clean and clear. No room for her sense that things like good and evil, right and wrong, bleed into each other, and create a dreadful margin of ambiguity no one could name, but could only enter. Enter at the risk of everything, because everything is at stake, and no one on earth knows what it means to enter, or what will happen if and when the testing of the margin is over. She could love her son, accept his guilt, accept the necessity of punishment, suffer with him, grow with him past the stage of blaming everyone but himself for his troubles, grieve with him when true penitence began to exact its toll. Though she might wish penance and absolution could be achieved in private, without the intervention of a prison sentence, she understood dues must be paid. He was her son, but he was also a man who had committed a robbery, in the course of which another woman's son had been killed. What would appall her, and what finally turned her against the forces of law and order, was the incapacity of the legal system to grant her son's humanity. Fair was the word she'd used, a John French word. She expected them to treat Robbie fair. Fairness was what made her willing to give him up to punishment, even though her love screamed no and her hands clung to his shoulders. Fairness was what she expected from the other side in their dealings with her and her son. She could see their side, but they steadfastly refused to see hers. And when she realized fairness was not forthcoming, she began to hate. In the lack of reciprocity, in the failure to grant that Robbie was first a man, then a man who had done wrong, the institutions and individuals who took over control of his life denied not only his humanity, but the very existence of the world that had nurtured him and nurtured her. The world of touching, laughing, suffering black people that established Robbie's claim to something more than a number. Mom expects the worst now. She's peeped their whole card. She understands that they have a master plan that leaves little to accident, that most of the ugliest things happening to black people are not accidental, but the predictable results of the working of the plan. What she learned about authority, about law and order, didn't make sense at first. It went against her instincts, what she wanted to believe, against the generosity she'd observed in her father's interactions with other Homewood people. He was fair. He'd pick up the egg rolls he loved from the back kitchen door of Mr. Wong's restaurant and not blame Wong, his old talking buddy and card-playing crony, for not serving black people in his restaurant. Wong had a family and depended on white folks to feed them, so Wong didn't have any choice, and neither did John French if he wanted those incredible egg rolls. He treated everyone, high and low, the same. He said what he meant and meant what he said. John French expected no more from other people than he expected from himself. And he'd been known to mess up many a time. But that was him. That was John French. No better, no worse than any man who pulls on his britches one leg at a time. He needed a little slack. Needed the benefit of that blind eye people who love, or people who want to get along with other people, must learn to cast. John French was grateful for the slack, so was quick to extend it to others, till they crossed him. My mother had been raised in Homewood, the old Homewood. Her relations with people in that close-knit, homogeneous community were based on trust, mutual respect, common spiritual and material concerns. Face-to-face contact, shared language and values, a large fund of communal experience rendered individual lives extremely visible in Homewood. Both a person's self-identity, you know who you are, and accountability, other people know who you are, were firmly established. If one of the Homewood people said, "That's the French girl," or "There goes John French's daughter," a portrait with subtle shading and complex resonance was painted by the words. If the listener addressed was also a Homewood resident, the speaker's voice located the young woman passing innocently down Tioga Street in a world invisible to outsiders. A French girl was somebody who lived in Casino Way, somebody you didn't fool with or talk nasty to, didn't speak to at all except in certain places or on certain occasions. French girls were church girls. Homewood African Methodist Episcopal Zion Sunday School picnic and social event young ladies. You wouldn't find them hanging around anywhere with escorts or chaperones. You heard things like that in Homewood names. Rules of etiquette, thumbnail character sketches, a history of the community. A dire warning to get back could be coded into the saying of a person's name. And a further inflection of the speaker's voice could tell you to ignore the facts, forget what he's just reminded you to remember, and go on, try your luck. Because Homewood was self-contained and possessed such a strong personality, because its people depended less on outsiders than they did on each other for so many of their basic satisfactions, they didn't notice the net settling over their community until it was already firmly in place. Even though the strands of the net, racial discrimination, economic exploitation, white hate and fear, had existed time out of mind. What people didn't notice or chose not to notice was that the net was being drawn tighter, that ruthless people outside the community had the power to choke the life out of Homewood, and as soon as it served their interests, would do just that. During the final stages, as the net closed like a fist around Homewood, my mother could pretend it wasn't there. But instead of setting her free, the truth trapped her in a cage as tangible as the iron bars of Robbie's cell. Some signs were subtle, gradual. The A&P started to die. Nobody mopped filth from the floors. Nobody bothered to restock empty shelves. Fewer and fewer white faces among the shoppers. A plate glass display window gets broken and stays broken. When they finally closed the store, they paced the going out of business notice over the jagged taped crack. Other signs as blatant, as sudden as fire engines and patrol cars breaking your sleep, screaming through the dark Homewood streets. First Garth's death, then Robbie's troubles brought it all home. My mother realized her personal unhappiness and grief were inseparable from what was happening out there. Out there had never been further away than the thousand insults and humiliations she had disciplined herself to ignore. What she had deemed petty, not worth bothering about, were strings of the net just as necessary, as effective as the most dramatic intrusions into her life. She decided to stop letting things go by. No more benefit of the doubt. Doubt had been cruelly excised. She decided to train herself to be as wary, as unforgiving as she'd once been ready to live and let live. My mother wouldn't become paranoid, not even overtly prickly or bristling. That would have been too contrary to her style, to what her blood and upbringing had instilled. The change was inside. What she thought of people, how she judged situations. Things she'd say or do startled me, set me back on my heels, because I didn't recognize my mother in them. I couldn't account for the stare of pure, unadulterated hatred she directed at the prison guard when he turned away from her to answer the phone before handing her the restroom key she'd requested. The vehemence with which she had cussed Richard Nixon for paying no taxes, when she, scraping by on an income of less than $4,000 a year, owed the IRS $300. Garth's death and Robbie's troubles were at the center of her new vision. Like a prism, they caught the light, transformed it so she could trace the seemingly random inconveniences and impositions coloring her life to their source in a master plan. I first heard Garth's story in the summer of 1975. The summer my wife carried our daughter Jamila in her belly. The summer before the robbery and killing. The story contained all the clues I'm trying to decipher now. Sitting in the kitchen, vaguely distracted by gospel music from the little clock radio atop the table, listening as my mother expressed her sorrow, her indignation at the way Garth was treated, her fears for my brother, I was hearing a new voice. Something about the voice struck me then, but I missed what was novel and crucial. I'd lost my Homewood ear. Missed all the things unsaid that invested her words with special urgency. People in Homewood often asked, "You said that to say what?" The impacted quality of an utterance either buries a point too obscurely or insists on a point so strongly that the listener wants the meat of the message repeated, wants it restated clearly so it stands alone on its own two feet. If I'd been alert enough to ask that question, to dig down to the root and core of Garth's story after my mother told it, I might have understood sooner how desperate and dangerous Homewood had become. 6 years later, my brother was in prison, and when he began the story of his troubles with Garth's death, a circle completed itself. Robbie was talking to me, but I was still on the outside looking in. That day, 6 years later, I talked with Robbie 3 hours, the maximum allotted time for weekday visits with a prisoner. It was the first time in life we'd ever talked that long. Probably 2.5 hours longer than the longest unbroken private conversation we'd ever had. And it had taken guards, locks, and bars to bring us together. The ironies of the situation, the irony of that fact, escaped neither of us. I listened mostly, interrupting my brother's story a few times to clarify dates or names, Much of what he related was familiar. The people, the places, even the voice, the words he chose were mine in a way, were so alike. I kept thinking, anticipating what he would say next, how he would say it, filling in naturally, easily with my words what he left unsaid. Trouble was, our minds weren't interchangeable, no more than our bodies. The guards wouldn't have allowed me to stay in my brother's place. He was the criminal, I was the visitor from outside, different as night and day. As Robbie talked, I let myself forget that difference, paid too much attention to myself listening, and lost some of what he was saying. What I missed would have helped define the difference. But I missed it. It was easy to half-listen, for both of us to pretend to be closer than we were. We needed the closeness. We were brothers. In the prison visiting lounge, I acted toward my brother the way I'd been acting toward him all my life, heard what I wanted to hear, rejected the rest. When Robbie talked, the similarity of his homewood and mine was a trap. I could believe I knew exactly what he was describing. I could relax into his story, walk down Dunfermline or Tioga, see my crippled grandmother sitting on the porch of the house on Finance, all the color her pale face had lost blooming in the rosebush beneath her in the yard, see Robbie in the downstairs hall of the house on Marchand, rapping with his girl on the phone which sat on a three-legged stand just inside the front door. I'd slip unaware out of his story into one of my own. I'd be following him, an obedient shadow. Then a cloud would blot the sun and I'd be gone, unchained, a dark form still skulking behind him but no longer in tow. The hardest habit to break, since it was the habit of a lifetime, would be listening to myself listen to him. That habit would destroy any chance of seeing my brother on his terms, and seeing him in his terms. Learning his terms seemed the whole point of learning his story. However numerous and comforting the similarities, we were different. The world had seized on the difference, allowed me room to thrive while he'd been forced into a cage. Why did it work out that way? What was the nature of the difference? Why did it haunt me? Temporarily, at least, to answer these questions, I had to root my fiction-writing self out of our exchanges. I had to teach myself to listen, start fresh, clear the pipes, resist too facile an identification, tame the urge to take off with Robbie's story and make it my own. I understood all that, but could I break the habit? And even if I did learn to listen, wouldn't there be a point at which I'd have to take over the telling? Wasn't there something fundamental in my writing, in my capacity to function, that depended on flight, on escape? Wasn't another person's skin a hiding place, a place to work out anxiety, to face threats too intimidating to handle in any other fashion? Wasn't writing about people a way of exploiting them? A stranger's gait, or eyes, or a piece of clothing can rivet my attention. Then it's like falling down to the center of the earth. Not exactly fear or panic, but an uneasy, uncontrollable momentum, a sense of being swallowed, engulfed in blackness that has no dimensions, no fixed points. That boundless, incarcerating black hole is another person. The detail grabbing me functions as a door, and it swings open, and I'm drawn, sucked, pulled in, head over heels, till suddenly I'm righted again, on track again, and the peculiarity, the ordinariness of the detail that usurped my attention, becomes a window, a way of seeing out of another person's eyes, just as, for a second, it had been my way in. I'm scooting along on short, stubby legs, and the legs are not anybody else's, and certainly not mine, but I feel for a second what it's like to motor through the world atop those peculiar duck thighs, and foreshortened calves, and I know how wobbly the earth feels under those run-over-at-the-heels, split-seam penny loafers. Then, just as suddenly, I'm back. I'm me again, slightly embarrassed, guilty because I've been trespassing, and don't know how long I've been gone or if anybody noticed me violating somebody else's turf. Do I write to escape, to make a fiction of my life? If I can't be trusted with the story of my own life, how could I ask my brother to trust me with his? The business of making a book together was new for both of us. Difficult. Awkward. Another book could be constructed about a writer who goes to a prison to interview his brother but comes away with his own story. The conversations with his brother would provide a stage for dramatizing the writer's tortured relationship to other people, himself, his craft. The writer's motives, the issue of exploitation, the inevitable conflict between his role as detached observer and his responsibility as a brother would be at the center of such a book. When I stopped hearing Robbie and listened to myself listening, that kind of book shouldered its way into my consciousness. I didn't like the feeling. That book compromised the intimacy I wanted to achieve with my brother. It was as obtrusive as the wherever pen in my hand. The little yellow sheets of yard count paper begged from the pad of the guard in charge of overseeing the visiting lounge. The borrowed pen and paper, I was not permitted into the lounge with my own, were necessary props. I couldn't rely on memory to get my brother's story down, and the keepers had refused my request to use a tape recorder. So there I was, Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter, poised on the edge of my seat, pen and paper at ready, asking to be treated as a brother. We were both rookies. Neither of us had learned very much about sharing our feelings with other family members. At home, it had been assumed that each family member possessed deep, powerful feelings, and that very little or nothing at all needed to be said about these feelings because we all were stuck with them, and talk wouldn't change them. Your particular feelings were a private matter, and family was a protective fence around everybody's privacy. Inside the perimeter of the fence, each family member resided in his or her own quarters. What transpired in each dwelling was mainly the business of its inhabitant, as long as nothing generated within an individual unit threatened the peace or safety of the whole. So, Robbie and I faced each other in the prison visiting lounge as familiar strangers, linked by blood and time. But how do you begin talking about blood, about time? He's been inside his privacy, and I've been inside mine, and neither of us, in 30-odd years, had felt the need to exchange more than social calls. We shared the common history, values, and style developed within the tall stockade of family, and that was enough to make us care about each other, enough to ensure a profound depth of mutual regard. But the feelings were undifferentiated. They'd seldom been tested specifically, concretely. His privacy and mine had been exclusive, sanctioned by family traditions. Don't get too close. Don't ask too many questions or give too many answers. Don't pry. Don't let what's inside slop out on the people around you. Robbie understood that he was sentenced to die, that all sentences were death sentences. If he didn't buckle under, the guards would do everything in their power to kill him. If he succumbed to the pressure to surrender dignity, self-respect, control over his own mind and body, then he'd become a beast, and what was good in him would die. The death sentence was unambiguous. The question for him became, how long could he survive in spite of the death sentence? Nothing he did would guarantee his safety. A disturbance in a cell block halfway across the prison could provide an excuse for shooting him and dumping him with the other victims. Any time he was ordered to go with guards out of sight of other prisoners, his escorts could claim he attacked them or attempted to escape. Since the flimsiest pretext would make murdering him acceptable, he had no means of protecting himself. Yet to maintain sanity, to minimize their opportunities to destroy him, he had to be constantly vigilant. He had to discipline himself to avoid confrontations. He had to weigh in terms of life and death every decision he made. He had to listen and obey his keeper's orders, but he also had to determine in certain threatening situations whether it was better to say no and keep himself out of a trap, or take his chances that this particular summons was not the one inviting him to his doom. Of course, to say no perpetuated his reputation as one who couldn't be controlled, a bad guy, a guy you never turn your back on, one of the prisoners out to get the guards. That rap made you more dangerous in the keeper's eyes and therefore increased the likelihood they'd be frightened into striking first. Saying no put you in no less jeopardy than going along with the program, because the program was contrived to kill you. Directly or indirectly, you knew where you were headed. What you didn't know was the schedule. Tomorrow, next week, a month, a minute. When would one of them get itchy, get beyond waiting a second longer? Would there be a plan, a contrived incident, a conspiracy they'd talk about and set up as they drank coffee in the guards' room? Or would it be the hair-trigger impulse of one of them who held a grudge, harbored an antipathy so elemental, so irrational, that it could express itself only in a burst of pure, unrestrained violence? If you're Robbie and have the will to survive, these are the possibilities you must constantly entertain. Vigilance is the price of survival. Beneath the vigilance, however, is a gnawing awareness boiling in the pit of your stomach. You can be as vigilant as you're able. You can keep fighting the good fight to survive, and still, your fate is out of your hands. If they decide to come for you in the morning, that's it. Your ass is grass, and those minutes and hours, days and years you painfully stitch together to put off the final reckoning won't matter at all. So the choice, difficult beyond words, to say yes or say no, is made in light of the knowledge that in the end, neither your yes nor your no matters. Your life is not in your hands. Robbie backtracks his story from Garth to another beginning, the house on Copeland Street in Shadyside, where we lived when he was born.
I know that has something to do with it, living in Shadyside with only white people around you. You remember how it was. Except for us and them couple other families, it was an all-white neighborhood. I got a thing about being black. See, black was like the forbidden fruit. Even when we went to Freed's in Homewood, Geraldine and them never let me go no farther than the end of the block. All them times I stayed over there, I didn't go past Mr. Conrad's house by the vacant lot, or the other corner where Billy Shields and them stayed. Started to wondering what was so different about a black neighborhood. I was just a little kid. I was curious. I really wanted to know why they didn't want me finding out what was over there. Be playing with the kids next door to Freed, you know, Sonny and Gumpy and them. But all the time I'm wondering, what's around the corner? What's up the street? Didn't care if it was bad or good or dangerous or what. I had to find out. If it's something bad, I figured they would have told me, tried to scare me off, but nobody said nothing except no. Don't go no farther than the corner. Then back home in Shadyside, nothing but white people, so I couldn't ask nobody what was special about black. Black was a mystery, and in my mind, I decided I'd find out what it was all about. Didn't care if it killed me. I was going to find out. One time, it was later, I was close to starting high school, I overheard Mommy and Geraldine and Sissy talking in Freed's kitchen. They was talking about us moving from Shadyside back to Homewood. The biggest thing they was worried about was me. How would it be for me being in Homewood and going to Westinghouse? I could tell they was scared, especially Mom. You know how she is. She didn't want to move. Homewood scared her. Not so much the place, but how I'd act if I got out there in the middle of it. She already knew I was wild, hard to handle. There'd be too much mess for me to get into in Homewood. She could see trouble coming. And she was right. Me and trouble hooked up. See, it was a question of being somebody. Being my own person. Like, Yuns had sports and good grades sewed up. Wasn't nothing I could do in school or sports that Yuns hadn't already done. People said, here comes another Weidman. He's gonna be a good student like his brothers and sister. That's the way it was supposed to be. I was another Weidman. The last one, the baby. And everybody knew how I was supposed to act. But something inside me said no. Didn't want to be like the rest of Yuns. Me? I had to be a rebel. Had to get out from under Yun's good grades and do. Way back then, I decided I wanted to be a star. I wanted to make it big, my way. I wanted the glamour. I wanted to sit high up. Figured out school and sports wasn't the way. I got to thinking my brothers and sister was squares. Loved y'all, but wasn't no room left for me. Had to figure out a new territory. I had to be a rebel. Along about junior high, I discovered Garfield. Started hanging out up on Garfield Hill. You know, partying and stuff up in Garfield, because that's where the life was. Garfield was black, and I'd finally found what I'd been looking for. That place they was trying to hide from me. It was heaven, you know? Hanging out with the fellas, drinking wine, and trying anything else we could get our hands on. And the ladies. Always a party on the weekends. Had me plenty of sweet little soft-legged Garfield ladies. Brothers run my butt off that hill more than a couple times behind messing with somebody's piece, but I'd be back the next weekend, because I'd found heaven. Looking back now, wasn't much to Garfield. Just a rinky-dink ghetto up on a hill, but it was the street. I'd found my place. Having a little bit of taste behind me, I couldn't wait to get to Homewood. In a way, I got mad with Mommy and the rest of them. Seemed to me like they was trying to hold me back from a good time. Seemed like they just didn't want me to have no fun. That's when I decided I'd go on about my own business. Do it my way. Because I wasn't getting no slack at home. They still expected me to be like my sister and brothers. They didn't know I thought Yuns was squares. Yeah, I knew I was hipper and groover than Yuns ever thought of being. Streetwise, into something. Had my own territory. And I was bad. I was a rebel. Wasn't following in nobody's footsteps but my own. And I was a hip cookie, you better believe it. Wasn't a hipper thing out there than your brother Rob. I couldn't wait for them to turn me loose in Homewood. Me being the youngest and all, the baby in the family, people always said, ain't he cute? That Robbie gonna be a lady killer. Been hearing that mess since day one, so ain't no surprise I started to believe in it.
Yinz had me pegged as a ladies' man, so that's what I was. The girls be talking the same trash everybody else did. Ain't he cute? Be petting me and spoiling me like I'm still the baby of the family, and I sure ain't gonna tell him to stop. Thought I was cute as the girls be telling me. Thought sure enough, I'm gonna be a star. I love to get up and show my behind. Must have been good at it too, because the teacher used to call me up in front of the class to perform. The kids would get real quiet. This is probably why the teacher got me up, keep the class quiet while she nods off, because they'd listen to me. Sure enough, pay attention. Performing always come natural to me. Wasn't nervous or nothing, just get up and do my thing. They liked for me to do impressions. I could mimic anybody. You remember how I'd do that silly stuff around the house. Anybody I'd see on TV or hear on a record, I could mimic to a T. Bob Hope, Nixon, Smokey Robinson, Ed Sullivan, white or black. I could talk just like them or sing a song just like they did. The class yell out a famous name and I'd do the one thing they wanted to hear. If things had gone another way, I've always believed I could have made it big in show business. If you could keep them little frisky kids in Liberty School quiet, you could handle any audience. Always could sing and do impressions. You remember Mom asking me to do them for you when you came home from college? I'd still be performing. Read poetry in the hole. The other fellas get real quiet and listen. Sing down in there, too. Nothing else to do, so we entertain each other. They always asking me to sing or read. Hey, Weidman, come on, man, and do something. Then it gets quiet while they're waiting for me to start. Quiet. It's already dark. You in your own cell and can't see nobody else. Barely enough light to read by. The other fellas can hear you, but it's just you and them walls. So it feels like being alone much as it feels like you're singing or reading to somebody else. Yeah, I read my own poems sometimes. Other times, I just start in on whatever book I happen to be reading. One of the books you sent me, maybe. Fellas like my poems. They say I write about the things they be thinking. Say it's like listening to their own self thinking. That's because we all down there together. What else you gonna do but think of the people on the outside? Your woman, your kids, or folks, if you got any. Just the same old sad shit we all be thinking all the time. That's what I write, and the fellas like to hear it. Funny how things go around like that. Go round and round and keep coming back to the same place. Teacher used to get me up to pacify the class, and I'm doing the same thing in prison. You said your teachers called on you to tell stories, didn't they? Yeah, it's funny how much we're alike. In spite of everything, I always believed that. Inside. The feeling side. I always believed we was the most alike out of all the kids. I see stuff in your books, the kind of things I be thinking or feeling. Your teachers got you up to tell stories. It's funny, ain't it? I listen to my brother Robbie. He unravels my voice. I sit with him in the darkness of the behavioral adjustment unit. My imagination creates something like a giant seashell enfolding and closing us. Its inner surface is velvet soft and black. A curving mirror doubling the darkness. Poems are gene tumors, petals of dusk, petals of dawn. I want to stop. Savor the sweet, solitary pleasure. The time stolen from time in the whole. But the image I'm creating is a trick of the glass. The mirror that would swallow Robbie and then chime to me, "You're the fairest of them all." The voice I hear issues from a crack in the glass. I'm two or three steps ahead of my brother, making fiction out of his words. Somebody needs to snatch me by the neck and say, stop. Stop and listen. Listen to him. The behavioral adjustment unit is, as one guard put it, a maximum security prison within a maximum security prison. The restricted housing unit, or hole or home block, is a squat two-story cement building containing 35 6x8-foot cells. The governor of Pennsylvania closed the area in 1972 because of inhumane conditions. But within a year, the hole was reopened. For at least 23 hours a day, the prisoners are confined to their cells. An hour of outdoor exercise is permitted only on days the guards choose to supervise it. Two meals are served 3 hours apart, then nothing except coffee and bread for the next 21. The regulation that limits the time an inmate can serve in the BAU for a single offense is routinely sidestepped by the keepers. Administrative custody is a provision allowing officials to cage men in the BAU indefinitely. Hunger strikes are one means the prisoners have employed to protest the harsh conditions of the penal unit. Hearings prompted by the strikes have produced no major changes in the way the hole operates. Law, due process, the rights of the prisoners are irrelevant to the functioning of this prison within a prison.
Robbie was sentenced to 6 months in the BAU because a guard suspected he was involved in an attempted escape. The fact that a hearing, held 6 months later, established Robbie's innocence was small consolation since he'd already served his time in the hole. Robbie tells me about the other side of being the youngest. Okay, you're everybody's pet, and that's boss. But on the other hand, you sometimes feel you're the least important. Always last, always bringing up the rear. You learn to do stuff on your own, because the older kids are always busy, off doing their things. And you're too young, left behind because you don't fit, or just because they forget you're back there. At the end, bringing up the rear. But when orders are given out, you sure get your share. John's coming home this weekend, clean up your room. Robbie remembers being forced to get a haircut on the occasion of one of my visits. Honor thy brother. Get your hair cut, your room rid up, and put on clean clothes. He'll be here with his family, and I don't want the house looking like a pig pen. I have to laugh at the image of myself as somebody to get a haircut for. Robbie must have been fit to be tied. The worst thing I did, the thing I feel most guilty behind, is stealing Mom's life. It's like I stole her youth. Can't nothing change that. I can't give back what's gone. Robbing white people didn't cause me to lose no sleep back then. Couldn't feel so bad about that. How you gonna feel sorry when society's so corrupt? When everybody got their hand out or got their hand in somebody else's pocket, and ain't no rules nobody listens to if they can get away with breaking them? How you gonna apply the rules? It was dog-eat-dog out there, so how was I supposed to feel sorry if I was doing what everybody else doing? I just got caught is all. I'm sorry about that. And damn sorry that guy Stavros got killed. But as far as what I did, as far as robbing white people, ain't no way I was gonna torture myself over that one. I tried to write Mom a letter. Not too long ago. Should say I did write a letter, and put it in an envelope and sent it, cause that's what I did. But I'd be crying so much trying to write it, I don't know what wound up in that letter. I wanted Mom to know I knew what I'd done. In a way, I wanted to say I was sorry for spoiling her life. After all she did for me, I turned around and made her life miserable. That's the wrongest thing I've done. And I wanted to say I was sorry, but kept seeing her face while I was writing the letter. I'd see her face, and it would get older while I was looking. She'd get this old woman's face, all lined and wrinkled and tired about the eyes. Wasn't nothing I could do but watch. Cause I'd done it. And I knew I'd done it. And all the letters in the world ain't gonna change her face. I sit and think about stuff like that all the time. It's better now. I think about other things too, you know, like trying to figure out what's really right and wrong, but there be days the guilt don't never go away. I'm the one made her tired, John. And that's my greatest sorrow. All the love that's in me she created. Then I went and let her down. When you in prison, you got plenty of time to think, that's for damn sure. Too much time. I've gone over and over my life. Every moment. Every little thing again and again. I lay down on my bed and watch it happening over and over like a movie. I get it all broke down in pieces, and then I break up the pieces, then I take the pieces of the pieces and run them through my hand so I remember every word a person said to me, or what I said to them. And I weigh the words till I think I know what each and every one meant, then I try to put it back together. Try to understand where I've been, why I did what I did. You got time for that in here. Time's all you got in here. Going over and over things. Sometimes you can make sense. That's why I did thus and so. Yeah. That's why I lost that job, or lost that woman, or broke that one's heart. You stop thinking in terms of something being good or evil. You just try to say this happened because that happened, because something else came first. You can spend days trying to figure out just one little thing you did. People out there walk around in a daze because they ain't got time to think. When I was out there, I wasn't no different. Had this Superfly thing, and that was the whole bit. Nobody could tell me nothing. Seems like I should start the story back in Shadyside, in the house on Copeland Street. Nothing but white kids around. Them little white kids had everything, too. That's what I thought, anyway. Nice houses, nice clothes. They could buy pop and comic books and candy when they wanted to. We wasn't that bad off, but compared to what them little white kids had, I always felt like I didn't have nothing. It made me kind of quiet and shy around them. Me knowing all the time I wanted what they had, wanted it bad. There was them white kids with everything. And then there was the black world Mommy and them was holding back from me. No place to turn, in a way.
I guess you could say I was stuck in the middle. Couldn't have what the white kids in Shadyside had, and I wasn't allowed to look around the corner for something else. So I'd start the story with Shadyside, the house on Copeland. December always been a bad month for me. One of the worst days in my life was in December. It's still one of the worst days in my life even after all this other mess. Jail, running, the whole bit. Been waiting to tell you this a long time. Ain't no reason to hold it back no longer. We into this telling the truth thing, so might as well tell it all. I'm still shamed, but here it is. You know that TV of y'all's got stolen from Mommy's? Well, I did it. It was me and Henry took y'all's TV that time and set the house up to look like a robbery. We did it. Took my own brother's TV. Couldn't hardly look you in the face for a long time after we done it. Was pretty sure y'all never knowed it was me, but I felt real bad round yins anyway. No way I was gonna confess, though. Too shamed. A junkie stealing from his own family. See, used to bullshit myself. Say I ain't like them other guys. They stone junkies, they hooked. Do anything for a hit, but me, I'm Robbie, I'm cool. I be believing that shit, too. Fooling myself. You gotta bullshit yourself when you fallin'. Gotta do it to live with yourself. See, but where it's at is, you be doing any goddamn thing for dope. You hooked, and that's all's to it. You a stone junkie just like the rest. Always wondered if you knew I took it. Mom was suspicious. She knew more than we did then about the dope, the seriousness of it. Money disappearing from her purse when nobody in the house but the two of you. Finding a syringe on the third floor. Stuff like that she hadn't talked about to us yet. So your stealing the TV was a possibility that came up. But to me, it was just one of many. One of the things that could have happened, along with a whole lot of other possibilities we sat around talking about. An unlikely possibility as far as I was concerned. Nobody wanted to believe it was you. Mom tried to tell us how it could be, but in my mind, you weren't the one. Haven't thought about it much since then, except as one of those things that make me worry about Mom living in the house alone. One of those things making Homewood dangerous, tearing it down. I'm glad I'm finally getting to tell you. I never could get it out. Didn't want you to think I'd steal from my own brother. Especially since all y'all done to help me out. You and Judy and the kids. Stealing y'all's TV don't make no sense, does it? But if we gon' get the story down, might as well get it all down. It was a while ago. You remember the year? 1971 was Greens, when we robbed Greens and got in big trouble, so it had to be the year before that, 1970. That's when it had to be. Yuns was home for Christmas. Mommy and them was having a big party. A reunion, kinda, because all the family was together. Everybody home for the first time in a long time. Tish in from Detroit, David back from Philly, Yuns in town. My birthday, too. Party's supposed to celebrate my birthday, too, since it came right along in there after Christmas. Maybe that's why I was feeling so bad. Knowing I had a birthday coming, and knowing at the same time how screwed up I was. Sat in a chair all day. I was hooked for the first time, good and hooked. Didn't know how low you could feel till that day. Cold and snowing outside, and I got the stone miseries inside. Couldn't move. Weak and sick. Henry, too. He was with me in the house, feeling bad as I was. We was two desperate dudes. Didn't have no money, and that Jones down on us. Mommy kept asking, "What's wrong with you two?" She was on my case all day. "What ails you, Robbie?" Gotta be about 3 o'clock, she come in the room again. "You better get up and get some decent clothes on. We're leaving for Gerald's soon." See, because it was the day of the big Christmas party. Gerald had baked a cake for me. Everybody was together, and they'd be singing, "Happy Birthday, Robbie," and do the whole bit. And I'm supposed to be guest of honor, and can't even move out the chair. Here I go again, disappointing everybody. Everybody be at Gerald's looking for me, and Gerald had a cake and everything. Where's Robbie? He's home dying because he can't get no dope. So I says, "Go on, I ain't ready. Yins, go on, I'll catch up with yins at Gerald's." Mommy's standing in the doorway. She can't say too much because Yins is home, and you ain't hip to what's happening. "Come on now, we can't wait any longer for you. Please get up, Gerald baked a cake for you. Everybody's looking forward to seeing you." Seems like she stands there an hour begging me to come. She ain't mad no more. She's begging. Just about ready to cry. Y'all in the other room. You can hear what she's saying, but you can't see her eyes. And they tearing me up. Her eyes begging me to get out that chair, and it's tearing me up to see her hurting so bad. But ain't nothing I can do. Jones sitting on my chest, and ain't no get up in me. "Yins, go ahead, Mommy. I'll be over in a little while.
be there to blow them candles out and cut the cake.
She knew better. Knew if I didn't come right then, chances was I wasn't coming at all. She knew, but wasn't nothing she could do. Guess I knew I was lying, too. Nothing in my mind except copping that dope. Yeah, Mom, be there to light them candles. I'm grinning, but she ain't smiling back. She knows I'm in trouble, deep trouble. I can see her today, standing in the doorway, begging me to come with yous. But it ain't meant to be. Me and Henry thought we'd come up with an idea. Henry's old man had some pistols. We gonna steal 'em and honk 'em, take the money and score. Then we'd be better. Wouldn't be no thing to hustle some money, get the guns out of hock, sneak the pistols back in Henry's house, everything be all right. Wouldn't even exactly be stealing from his old man. Like we just borrowing the pistols till we score and take care of business. Henry's old man wouldn't even know his pistol's missing. Slick. Slick as we was, thinking we slick. 100 times, Mom must have poked her head in the room 100 times. What's wrong with you? Like a drum beating in my head. What's wrong with you? But the other thing is stronger. The dope is talking to me louder. It says, get you some. It says, you ain't never gonna get better less you cop. We waited long as we could, but it didn't turn no better outside. Still snowing, wind shaking the whole house. How we gonna walk to Henry's and steal them pistols? Henry live way up on the hill. All the way up Toke, then you still got a long way to go over into the projects. Can't make it. No way we gonna climb Toke. So then what? Everybody's left for Gerald's. Then I remembers the TV yous brought. A little portable Sony black and white, right? You and Judy sleeping in Mom's room, and she has her TV already in there, so the Sony ain't unpacked. Saw it sitting with y'all's suitcases over by the dresser. On top the dresser in a box. Remembered it. And soon's I did, I knew we had to have it. Sick as I was, that TV had to go. Wouldn't really be stealing. Borrow it instead of borrowing the pistols, pawn it, get straight, steal some money and buy it back. Just borrowing y'all's TV. Won't take me and Henry no time to rob something and buy back the TV. We stone thieves. Just had to get well first so we could operate. So we took y'all's TV and set the house up to look like a robbery. I'm remembering the day. Wondering why it had slipped completely from my mind. I feel like a stranger, yet as Robbie talks, my memory confirms details of his recollection. I admit, yes, I was there. That's the way it was. But where was I? Who was I? How did I miss so much? His confessions make me uncomfortable. Instead of concentrating on what he's revealing, I'm pushed into considering all the things I could be confessing, should be confessing, but haven't, and probably won't ever. I feel hypocritical. Why should I allow my brother to repose a confidence in me when it's beyond my power to reciprocate? Shouldn't I confess that first? My embarrassment, my uneasiness, the clinical, analytic coldness settling over me when I catch on to what's about to happen? I have a lot to hide. Places inside myself where truth hurts, where incriminating secrets are hidden, places I avoid or deny most of the time. Pulling one piece of that debris to the surface, airing it in the light of day, doesn't accomplish much. Doesn't clarify the rest of what's buried down there. What I feel when I delve deeply into myself is chaos. Chaos and contradiction. So how upfront can I get? I'm moved by Robbie's secrets. The heart I have is breaking. But what that heart is and where it is, I can't say. I can't depend on it. So he shouldn't. Part of me goes out to him. Heartbreak is the sound of ice cracking. Deep, layers and layers muffling the sound. I listen, but I can't trust myself. I have no desire to tell everything about myself, so I resist his attempt to be upfront with me. The chaos at my core must be in his. His confession pushes me to think of all the stuff I should lay on him, and that scares the shit out of me. I don't like to feel dirty, but that's how I feel when people try to come clean with me. Very complicated, and very simple, too. The fact is, I don't believe in clean. What I know best is myself, and knowing what I know about myself, clean seems impossible. A dream. One of those better selves occasionally in the driver's seat, but nothing more. Nothing to be depended upon. A self, no more or less in control than the countless other selves who each, for a time, seem to be running things. Chaos is what he's addressing. What his candor, his frankness, his confession echo against.
Chaos and time and circumstance and the old news, the bad news that we still walk in circles, each of us trapped in his own little world, behind bars, locked in our cells. But my heart can break, does break, just listening to my brother's pain. I just remember differently. Different parts of the incident he's describing come back. Strange thing is, my recollections return through the door he opened. My memories needed his. Maybe the fact that we recall different things is crucial. Maybe they are foreground and background, propping each other up. He holds on to this or that scrap of the past, and I listen to what he saved, and it's not mine, not what I saw or heard or felt. The pressure's on me, then. If his version of the past is real, then what's mine? Where does it fit? As he stitches his memories together, they bridge a vast emptiness. The time lost enveloping us all. Everything. And hearing him talk, listening to him try to make something of nothing, challenges me. My sense of the emptiness playing around his words, any words, is intensified. Words are nothing and everything. If I don't speak, I have no past, except the nothing, the emptiness. My brother's memories are not mine, so I have to break into the silence with my own version of the past, my words, my whistling in the dark. His story freeing me, because it forces me to tell my own. I'm sorry you took so long to forgive yourself. I forgave you a long time ago, in advance for a sin I didn't even know you'd committed. You lied to me, you stole from me. I'm in prison now listening, because we committed those sins against each other countless times. I want your forgiveness. Talking about debts you owe makes me awkward, uneasy. We remember things differently. They set us apart. They bring us together, searching for what is lost, for the meaning of difference, of distance. For instance, the Sony TV. It was a present from Mort, Judy's dad. When we told him about the break-in and robbery at Mom's house, he bought us another Sony. Later, we discovered the stolen TV was covered by our homeowner's policy even though we'd lost it in Pittsburgh. A claim was filed, and eventually we collected around $100. Not enough to buy a new Sony, but a good portion of the purchase price. Seemed a lark when the check arrived. Pennies from heaven. $100 free and clear since we already had the new TV Mort had surprised us with. About a year later, one of us, Judy or I, was telling the story of the robbery and how well we came out of it. Not until that very moment when I caught a glimpse of Mort's face out of the corner of my eye did I realize what we'd done. Judy remembers urging me to send Mort that insurance check, and she probably did, but I have no recollection of an argument. In my mind, there had never been an issue. Why shouldn't we keep the money? But when I saw the look of surprise and hurt flash across Mort's face, I knew the insurance check should have gone directly to him. He's a generous man and probably would have refused to accept it, but we'd taken advantage of his generosity by not offering the check as soon as we received it. Clearly the money belonged to him. Unasked, he'd replaced the lost TV. I had treated him like an institution, one of those faceless corporate entities like the gas company or IRS. By the time I saw the surprise in Mort's face and understood how selfishly, thoughtlessly, even corruptly I'd behaved, it was too late. Offering Mort $100 at that point would have been insulting. Anything I could think of saying sounded hopelessly lame, inept. I'd screwed up. I'd injured someone who'd been nothing but kind and generous to me. Not intentionally, consciously, but that only made the whole business worse in a way, because I'd failed him instinctively. The failure was a measure of who I was. What I'd unthinkingly done revealed something about my relationship to Mort I'm sure he'd rather not have discovered. No way I could take my action back, make it up. It reflected a truth about who I was. That memory pops right up. Compromising, ugly. Ironically, it's also about stealing from a relative. Not to buy dope, but to feed a habit just as self-destructive. The habit of taking good fortune for granted. The habit of blind self-absorption that allows us to believe the world owes us everything and we are not responsible for giving anything in return. Spoiled children. The good coming our way taken as our due. No strings attached. Lots of other recollections were triggered as Robbie spoke of that winter and the lost TV. The shock of walking into a burgled house. How it makes you feel unclean. How quickly you lose the sense of privacy and security a house, any place you call home, is supposed to provide. It's a form of rape. Forced entry. Violation. Brutal hands defiling what's personal and precious. The aftershock of seeing your possessions strewn about, broken, Fear gnawing at you, because what you thought was safe isn't safe at all. The worst has happened and can happen again. Your sanctuary has been destroyed. Anytime you walk in your door, you may be greeted by the same scene. Or worse, you may stumble upon the thieves themselves. The symbolic rape of your dwelling place enacted on your actual body, real screams, real blood, a knife at your throat, a stranger's weight bearing down. Mom put it in different words, but she was as shaken as I was when we walked into her house after Gerald's party. Given what I know now, she must have been even more profoundly disturbed than I imagined. A double bind. Bad enough to be ripped off by anonymous thieves. How much worse if the thief is your son? For Mom, the robbery was proof Robbie was gone. Somebody else walking around in his skin. Mom was wounded in ways I hadn't begun to guess at. At the root of her pain were your troubles. The troubles stealing you away from her, from all of us. The troubles thick in the air as that snow you're remembering. The troubles falling on your head and mine. Troubles I refuse to see.